FS Insider, a premium edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Today's host is Financial Sense Wealth Management President, Jim Poplava.
It's hard to believe, with the economy growing at 4% a year, the stock market up 300%. 10 years ago, the country was in the midst of its worst financial crisis since the recession. Unfortunately, then, neither economists, Wall Street analysts, the financial media, or two Fed governors could see it coming. Well, today, we have the privilege of talking to one of those individuals who did. Joining me on the program is A. Gary Schilling. He is author and editor of A. Gary Schilling's Insight. Gary, I want to go back maybe more than 15 years ago. You began to alert your subscribers to a possible housing crisis. What were you watching back then? What did you see that alerted you to the coming financial crisis that eventually transpired?
Well, Jim, as you know, I sort of made a career at looking for bubbles. And these are obviously important because when they break, they can be rather disastrous for those who thought they were going to last forever. And also, there are so few people who are willing to ever bet on anything but onward and upward forever that you don't have a crowded trade when you're forecasting the demise of a bubble. So I've sort of specialized in that, and I guess I've had pretty good luck on it. As a matter of fact, in our go back to our April insight of this year, I have an article titled Seven Great Calls, and these are things that over my career I felt deserved that qualification, that name, and obviously this housing bubble was one of them. So I'm constantly on the alert for things that look like they're out of line with reality. In the case of housing, we actually started in 2002 saying it looked like a housing bubble was developing. Didn't know how long it would go, how far it would run, but felt that it had the possibilities of developing into a full blown bubble, and then a collapse would lead to a disaster. So we were following this all along, and the whole thing really didn't break until 2007 when you started to see the collapse in housing. But what were we looking at? We were looking at things that were just ridiculous. I mean, for example, when you got to these no documentation loans, where people didn't have to verify their income or their assets, and they could borrow money when they were lending more than 100% of the appraised value on a house. They give them a mortgage and then what we call a piggyback loan, a home improvement loan on top. They were borrowing maybe 120% on a appraised value, and the appraisers were, they were all in cahoots. They were pushing up the numbers way above what they actually could sell these properties for. So you saw these excesses develop. You saw people who were flipping houses before they even were started. They buy them and flip them. You saw a situation where lenders were telling people that they could buy a house. They didn't have to put anything down because of these big mortgages. And they never have to make a payment because the appreciation was so great that they could refinance it before the first mortgage payment was due, and actually take money out of the deal. Now, when you see that kind of stuff, it comes under what I think, to me, sums up the whole of economic reality. There's no such thing as free lunch. I mean, in other words, economics deals with limited resources. There's nothing much, even the air isn't free anymore. And so when you people have expectations and are betting and investing on the basis that there is free lunch, you say this is going to come a cropper sooner or later. Obviously, it's tricky to get the exact time of the demise, but you know, we followed this up and wrote numerous times on this. We had a whole page of quotes that this article that Howard Gold wrote and featured me actually first of the four. He quoted some of those, but we had a kind, and what was interesting, the refrain from the experts supposedly was quite the opposite. You know, here's one from Ben Bernanke, two Fed chairmen ago. This is July 1st, 2005. We've never had a decline in house prices on a nationwide basis. We actually have in the 1930s. He ought to know better. He's a historian. But anyway, he goes on. So what I think, what is more like likely is that house prices will slow, maybe stabilize, maybe slow consumption spending a bit. I don't think it's going to drive the economy too far from its full employment path, though. July 1st, 2005. Now here, March again, Bernanke, March 28th, 2007. And housing, actually, it started to break in February of 2007. That's when the derivatives on subprime mortgages, called APS BBB minus, they were collapsing, and New Century, a big housing lender, was reported very bad fourth quarter earnings. But here's what Bernanke said March 28th. At this juncture, however, the impact on the broader economy and financial markets of the problems in the subprime mortgage seem likely to be contained. So he was obviously not alone. He was in a vast majority who just didn't understand the depths of this. And I think they come in with this bias that nothing really can go wrong. And the Fed is notorious for never forecasting any downturns. And most economists aren't. Most economists that work in private industry are paid to be bullish. They have a bias not toward looking toward any kind of bubbles. And this was a classic case in point.
Gary, let me ask you, I mean, you work around Wall Street officials, some of the brightest minds in the business on Wall Street. What were these guys thinking that were running financial institutions that were doing no doc loans, ninja loans, 100% of value? What were they thinking? I mean, this defies any sense of logic that this would turn out other than what it did. What were they thinking?
It's hard to know exactly what they were thinking. I mean, first of all, they were making so much money out of this that their judgment was undoubtedly clouded. Some of them, in addition, might have figured, well, okay, I'm a smart guy. I'll get out before it collapses. You know, after me, the deluge, as Louis XIV said. And others may have just been oblivious to what was going on. They didn't really understand it. I mean, this got involved in things like credit default swaps that most sort of straight investors, you know, 60 stocks, 40 bonds, something. They didn't even know what they were. So I think it was probably a combination of all these things, and also just the hope that everything holds together, because that's what made money for people in Wall Street, and Wall Street people are by and large interested in money. They're not interested in much else of anything except making money.
You know what really struck me is you had the largest insurer in the world, AIG. This was a $1 trillion company, and yet a group of guys out of London on the credit default swap desk were making these complex instruments and selling them, making a fortune. Do you ever wonder, Gary, the guys at the top sometimes don't really understand what the trading desk is doing?
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. You really wonder whether the AIG officials understood what these guys, and you're correct in what they were doing in London. They were selling these credit default swaps. I mean, I was involved with John Paulson. We were buying them. We were on the other side, and that's where we made a lot of money when they collapsed. But I don't think AIG people knew. I mean, you look at other cases. Jamie Dimon, head of J.P. Morgan Chase, you know, he's on record as saying he knows all the joints and muscles in his bank. And yet this London whale, it cost him $6 billion. And he didn't know what was going on. Now, you know, you kind of say, are these institutions just too big and too far from where the tire meets the pavement, that the guys running them just don't know what's going on? You know, you really wonder if that's the case, because finance is so heavily leveraged that the people running it can take huge risks. And we saw that with Bear Stearns. We saw that with Lehman. Huge, huge, unbelievable risks. Where they're leveraging their capital, you know, 50, 60, 70 times. And so they can take these huge bets. And obviously, if they have just a minor correction, boy, they're out of business. And I think a lot of them just don't understand that the risks that they're involved in. And of course, a lot of them, it wasn't really their money. I mean, it wasn't the old partnership days when they were personally going to end up in the poorhouse. They walk away with severance packages a lot of times and get another job, and they're back in business in a couple of years. So, you know, from their standpoint, there isn't quite the risk that I would have of running my business anyway.
I want to talk about your involvement with John Paulson. As you began writing about this in your newsletter, Insight, you caught the eye of Greg Lipman, of anybody aware of him. He was featured in The Big Short. But you also were contacted by John Paulson, who literally made billions of dollars in this. So let's talk about that, because most you not only saw it coming, but you were able to take advantage of it. As you just mentioned, as AIG was selling credit default swaps, you were on the other side of that trade.
Yeah. Well, just go back to Lipman. It's interesting. In January of 2006, I got a call out of the blue from Greg Lipman. I didn't know who he was. He was at Deutsche Bank, and he had seen some of my insights, a very negative on housing. And he said, I'll tell you how you can make a lot of money. So he explained credit default swaps. I thought the guy was a snake oil salesman. I never heard of credit default swaps. So I took notes. I threw them in a pile of paper and forgot about them. Well, then later, and I'll come back to Paulson, but later, after I was heavily involved in with Paulson, I was cleaning stuff out, and I said, good grief, Glibben was telling me exactly what we're doing at Paulson. So I called him up. We set up a nice consulting relationship, and they nearly closed him down at Deutsche Bank because he was early, and timing is very, very important on these things. But he ended up making over $1 billion for Deutsche Bank, and that offset what the Deutsche Bank people on the other side were doing. In other words, they were writing their credit default swaps. He was buying them. They didn't know each other existed. But anyway, going back to Paulson, I got a call from Paulson, from his head trader in July of 2006. And he, again, somebody from Goldman Sachs, one of our clients, had passed on our reports. And he called me in and he said, I want to form a advisory council. I'd like you to be the first member. I said, fine. And we set up a nice consulting relationship, and he had just launched this credit opportunities fund, which basically was buying these credit default swaps. And what they are is they are puts. In other words, you're paying a premium up front. You can only use your premium, but in this case, your upside is open-ended. And when I figured out what he was doing, I said, you know, it was an aha moment, because I've been looking for a way to have a very attractive gain on a collapse in subprime housing. Now, you can short stocks, but you can only make 100% on your trade. They go to zero, you make 100%, and that's it. So I was looking for something, and Paulson had the vehicle. So in August, I put for what was the shillings, a major piece of change in this credit opportunity fund. You know, nothing really happened until early 07, and then things started to collapse. And I mention that because Paulson he had it figured out, and he was right on the timing. There were a number of other guys, and they show up in the big short, some of them, who were right, but they were early. They had limited partnerships, hedge funds, and their limited partners just closed them down. They couldn't wait. I mean, Glibben was losing $50 million a month, and he almost got closed down by Deutsche Bank officials. So timing was very important, as well as being right. I figured out what I wanted to do. Paulson had the vehicle. He wanted me to help substantiate his feeling and to sell it to prospects for this fund and so on. And I truly believed it. So that's how we got together. And they say it made 15 times on my money.
You know, the thing that you just mentioned that is somewhat scary in a sense is Lipman was taking the other side of the trade at the same bank, and neither side knew they were doing this. This gets back to, you know, these large financial institutions at the top,
yeah,
that the guy at the top doesn't even know what's going on with the trade desk. So here you had the trade desk, different sides of it, taking opposite sides of the bet. Let me ask you this. As a result of the financial crisis, we got regulation, we got Dodd-Frank. But Gary, as we came out of that financial crisis, the banks got bigger. Today, there's what, two or three investment banks left? The banks, I think the top four banks have the bulk of the nation's deposits. So when we came out of the crisis, everybody got upset about bailing out the bankers. But you look at the banking system today, it's bigger than it ever was.
Well, I'll tell you sort of an interesting anecdote that is a good example of that, Jim. I was with White Wealth before I set up my own firm in 1978. White Wealth was basically an investment banking house. Well, on one time, and the president of White Wealth told his story to the executive board I was on, he had gone over for lunch with Cy Lewis. Cy Lewis was running Bear Stearns, and Cy Lewis was a consummate trader. His office had a big plate glass window. I never saw it, but this is the way he described it, overlooking the trading floor. And Sive says to this CEO of Lightwell, he said, "Do you have traders who trade securities?" "Yeah, we do." And he says, "Do you know anything about it?" He said, "No, I'm a corporate finance guy." He said, "Do any of your senior officers know?" And he said, "No." And Lewis says, "And you're entrusting those traders with your money and you don't know what they're doing with it?"
Oh, my goodness.
And this guy came back and he thought that was a joke. He thought that was a big joke. But, of course, we saw that amply proved, and they're pointing out whether it was AIG, whether it was J.P. Morgan Chase, whether it was any of these, Deutsche Bank. Yeah, they really just didn't know what was going on. Now, of course, in normal times, you know, you have huge leverage in big financial institutions like any big organization. And if things are running smoothly, you know, these potential flaws don't come up. But when they do come up, they can be disastrous. And you kind of say, you know, how do you balance this out? How do you, you want to limit the size of institutions so there's less risk? Now, Dodd-Frank supposedly did that, but it, as you point out, it really wasn't that effective. Or do you just want to say, well, we'll take the growth on the upside and realize we're going to have the big declines occasionally on the downside? But I just find it amazing when you see the leverage in these institutions by people who couldn't possibly know what really is going on down on the trading floor.
When you take a look at all of this, and you've had a history of predicting bubbles in a very successful career in doing that. Gary, was there ever a time when you were looking at a bubble that perhaps it went on longer than it did, and you began to doubt maybe your own convictions?
That's completely normal because, first of all, bubbles go further than rationally you can ever expect them to go. And that's the reason they're bubbles. They're bubbles when they get to the point when they depart from reality. There's usually some reality to start. I mean, the other idea of subprime mortgages getting more people in housing or couldn't afford it, as a basic concept, no problem. But you get into the bubble stage, and it departs from reality, and then you're in the stage of why you want to buy it, because it's going up. there's no fundamental rationale. So they always run further than you expect. Secondly, yeah. You have to doubt your views, of course, because you hear, like, you know, with housing, I had this position and we're waiting patiently there for, well, from 2002 really until 2007 when the whole thing started to break. I mean, I wasn't invested then, but I was certainly watching it, and I wasn't in on the upside on housing. And you see all these people, you know, here's Joe Doakes who is working in a shoe store. And he's making a fortune flipping houses, and you say, "God, Schilling, you're supposedly know what's going on," and you feel like an idiot.
I want to talk about a possible bubble that you've identified, and that is this $8 trillion denominated emerging market corporate and sovereign debt. And Gary, we have— That's in dollars. And you have the Fed, which is raising interest rates. The dollar is strengthening. The more the dollar strengthens, the more expensive those debts get for those that borrowed it. So let's talk about that, because you've identified that as a possible another bubble.
Yeah, it is. Now, it's not staring in the face the way that subprime mortgage was, at least staring me in the face, and from my perception, or before that, the dot-com blow-off in the late 90s. And you remember all the nonsense going back there where companies were going public. They didn't have any earnings. They didn't have any revenues. They had maybe at best a business plan. And, I mean, those at least to me were very obvious that they were bubbles. They were going to, the subprime situation is potentially a bubble. It is a bubble, but potentially one that when it breaks will be big enough to cause major damage. The real question at this point is, will contagion set in? We already have, you know, major problems in Turkey and Argentina. Venezuela's a basket case. You wonder why they don't have a revolution there. But will those things move on to affect other emerging markets? And of course, the parallel for that was in the late 90s, 1998. Thailand ran into currency problems, balance of payments problems. They had pegged currencies back then. So when they really went big. And then that spread throughout Southeast Asia and to Latin America, Brazil, Argentina, and ultimately to Russia. And But even then, it didn't sink the developed world. I mean, we had a mild recession in 2001, but that was the aftermath of the subprime blow off and the Fed was tightening a bit and so on. So you can't say even that was solely due to the emerging market blow off. So there are two questions. One is this going to be contagious? And then secondly, will that be big enough to really constitute a major setback, a major financial crisis? But the one thing you can really say about financial crises, they invariably are caused by excess debt, excess leverage, too much borrowing in relation to the equity involved. And that's the case with these developing countries now, just as it was like the subprime mortgages and just like it was with the dot-com stocks.
So when you have what the Fed is doing now, the Fed is focusing on what's happening here in the U.S. They're trying to get normalized monetary policy. But sometimes, Gary, as you just mentioned now, the side effects of what the Fed is doing, it's causing the dollar to strengthen, which is making these loans more expensive. It's raising the cost of borrowing. Sometimes the Fed does stuff that has global implications. Is it possible if we see another emerging market crisis like we did in, let's say, 98, or let's say in Mexico back in 1981, that the Fed could actually pull back because that impact of that comes to the U.S. shores and starts to impact our economy?
It's certainly possible. My feeling, matter of fact, I'm just doing for our October Insight newsletter an article on this whole thing and pointing out that I think it is the strength in the dollar, which is really ultimately the problem for these countries, because the dollar had been weak earlier and they were borrowing in dollars that they abandoned. They could, they took fewer of their local currencies to repay the debt and so on. Well, now that's reversed with the Fed tightening and the dollar strengthening, and the dollar is a safe haven. And the dollar actually, it was declining from 1985 until early this year, and I think we may be on a multi-year dollar rally, which means these countries could be in trouble for a long time. Anyway, but the Fed has two major goals in their charter. One is price stability, and they define that now as 2% inflation and full employment, which they really stopped trying to define because the employment data doesn't really tell you the whole story with so many people having dropped out of the labor force. But those are their goals. They are domestic. The important thing is they're domestic. And I've never known the Fed to make a major policy move to help the rest of the world if it wasn't in line with what they want to do domestically. In other words, domestic is first. Now, it doesn't mean they aren't happy to help the rest of the world if it does not violate what they want to do domestically. But right now, the Fed is—they've got the bit in their mouth. They want to have higher interest rates, and if emerging markets really collapse to the point that the Fed said, "Well, this could be disruptive to U.S. companies and finance and banks," they could at least pause. But I think it would take concrete evidence that it was going to affect the U.S. before they would change their pattern. At least that's what history suggests.
So as you look at where we are today, we're in the middle of a Fed rate raising cycle. You have been a lot more cautious with your subscribers. Let's talk about that. What do you see? What's bringing that caution? And where would you be as an investor?
Well, there's no question that I have been cautious in recent years, and stock market in particular has continued to run up and in retrospect, obviously, I was too cautious. Right now, I think that caution is probably warranted because we have had a long run in stocks. It was fueled at least until recently by Fed money bailing out Wall Street, cutting interest rates to basically zero, then quantitative easing, just flooding the world with liquidity. But the Fed is moving the other way now, and secondly, stocks are very expensive by historical standards. And, the economy, it's growing okay, but it's not running away. And you don't know what the effects of this protectionism and any spillover from emerging markets might be. So I think that caution now is warranted. What do you do in this situation? Well, in our portfolios that we run, and we do manage money, we are long the dollar. I think that, the dollar is probably in for a multi-year run on the upside. And that, as I mentioned earlier, is really a nemesis for these emerging markets that have borrowed heavily in dollars, because now it takes more of the local currency to pay the interest and the principal on those debts. Also, most commodities around the world are priced in dollars. So when they import commodities, it costs more in their local currency to pay for those imports, even if the dollar price hasn't changed. So you do have this spillover effect. So, you know, we come out with saying, okay, we're long the dollar, we're short emerging markets one way or the other. But there are some things domestically that we like. And I think these are longer term plays. So one is aerospace and defense. As long as Republicans are in control in Washington, they are concerned about what's happening in China with building these artificial islands in the South China Sea, with Russia in Ukraine, Japan coming out from under their post-war neutrality, and so on. So aerospace and defense. Healthcare is another area we've been very bullish on for a long time, because you got the post-war babies retiring more and more money going into medical services. Now, you know, cost control is something that medicine is just not learned about, and that could come in as a factor, good for the economy, but maybe somewhat of a curtailment on the profits in the medical area. But you know, I think particularly the retiring post-war babies, this is a long-term area as well. So there are some areas that we're interested in domestically, but we've got more cash in our portfolios than I think we've ever had. I just like to have that cushion. If there is a big sell-off here at some point, I want to be in a position to buy a lot lower. You know, the problem is if you ride stocks down, most people give up just about the bottom. You know, the evidence is that mutual fund holders make less on their mutual funds than the mutual funds show in their total return. Why? Because they buy at the peak and sell at the trough. They don't ride them out through the whole cycle. They think they will, but most people throw in the towel just at the wrong time, and they don't get back in until it's a lot of the recovery is over. That idea of, you know, buy and hold is in my view very questionable. I think you need to take some preemptive action.
You know, you bring up a very good point. As we began this interview, you started talking about the housing crisis 3 or 4 years before it happened. And even Paulson's fund itself, thank goodness he was liquid and he had the cash reserves, because when he started it, it would take some time before it came to fruition and paid off handsomely. And that's what you have to do with investing, because I think, Gary, when you have the markets going up like it has, especially the last couple of years under Trump, there's this feeling that this trend will continue indefinitely. So people tend to be fully invested because they don't want to miss out. And you never know that one event, whether it's a Lehman Brothers, a Bear Stearns, whatever that event is, it finally turns the tables and it goes in the opposite direction. Gary, as we close, I wonder if you would just speak briefly about your newsletter. I love reading it each month because it's called Insight and it is very insightful. So if you could speak to that and how our listeners can find out more information about it.
Sure. It's a monthly publication. If anybody's interested, we can send them a sample copy. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-346-7444, or they can go to our website, agaryschilling.com, and can find it on there. And matter of fact, I'm right now working on our October issue. We're going to be talking about these underdeveloped countries. And we're also going to talk another interesting topic, oil. You know, it wasn't too many years ago when the feeling was that the world was running out of petroleum. And now the arguments have shifted around to saying demand is going to falter and there's going to be too much energy. And I want to point out that you got to be careful with extreme forecasts one way or the other, and this is a classic case.
All right. Well, listen, Gary, as always, I appreciate you coming on the program. It was a great delight to see you mentioned in the MarketWatch article as one of the few that did see the crisis coming, which is really speaks to your whole career as you've spotted a number of them. Gary, all the best, and come back and speak with us again.
Well, Jim, I look forward to it. I always enjoy it. You're a great interviewer, and I always look forward to these calls.
All right. Thanks. Well, thanks. We'll talk to you again. That concludes my interview with A. Gary Schilling. I had the privilege of meeting Gary early on in my career in the early 80s, and it changed the way I thought about investments. I got in the markets and in this business. the latter part of the 70s, the early part of the 80s, when inflation was running double digits, oil prices were at 40, gold got up to 800, and everybody was talking about inflation. And along comes this guy, Gary Shilling, and he writes a book, Deflation, Ready or Not. And he nailed it, and he changed my thinking. And he's made a career of making prescient calls. And he wrote a book, it was in 2010, called The Age of Deleveraging, The Era of Slow Growth, which is exactly what we've seen transpire these last 10 years. So go to Amazon, take a look at the book, and if you want, give him a call and get a sample copy of his newsletter. Very insightful. I'm Jim Poplava. Thanks for listening.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.